This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Hello. Yes, it's Mary Guerin here on this public holiday Monday. And I have not one, but two barbecue stopping questions for you. Feel free to throw either of these questions around if your party's going quiet today. What do you think of Harry and Meghan visiting Melbourne next month? Yes, the former royals are coming back. It's been confirmed. Do you want them? Will you try to see them? Do you care? That's one. Here's the other. Was Timothée Chalamet right? He said over the weekend he didn't want to be working. Actually, I think it was last month, but it was just picked up this weekend. He didn't want to be working in either ballet or opera because those art forms need to fight to survive because audiences don't care about them. Mm-hmm. He said that. Those words came out of his mouth. Well, that sparked a fair bit of outrage. But does he have a point? I'd love to know, even if you are a ballet or opera lover, is there not some harsh truth to what he's saying? Let me know. Hello, and yes, welcome to The Conversation Hour. I'm Mary Guerin. I'm filling in for Rochelle Hunt till the end of the year. Such a privilege to be in her chair for that time. And I hope you can join me every day. Join me either here, live, or anytime via the podcast on your ABC Listen app. I'd love to hear from you. And tell me, I'm new. I want to know, what are the conversations you want to hear? Let me know. Write to me at conversationhour@abc.net.au. All one word, conversationhour@abc.net.au. I'd love to know. We've got a terrific hour ahead. Timothée picked a fight with a couple of art forms, and we're going to talk to someone in one of those esteemed arts who is maybe, as we speak, pushing up their sleeves to take him on. But first, the Harry Meghan tour is coming back.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So Harry and Meghan, the artists formerly known as Royals, are coming back to Melbourne and Sydney next month. We don't have any details yet on what they'll be doing here. I've asked the state government if they have any ideas, or are we paying taxpayer dollars to spend on any of their security or anything? We don't know. We haven't got answers yet. Do you want them? What do you think? 1300 222 774 is the number to call, or 0437 774 774. When they came here more than 7 years ago, you might remember they had their royal titles then, newlyweds, lots of coverage, lots of interest. Now they're coming back as not quite as common as, let's face it, but private citizens at least, and a spokesperson has confirmed they will visit Australia in mid-April to take part in a number of private business and philanthropic engagements. Few further details will be shared in due course. And of course, this is in the wake of more revelations and allegations about Andrew, the artist formerly known as Prince and Duke. Joining me now is Juliet Reedon, author and the ABC's royal commentator. Hello, Juliet.
Hello there.
What do you think? We will talk about Andrew in a moment, but let's talk about Harry and Meghan. What do you make of the news?
Well, it's quite a surprise, actually, although I do understand that it's been sort of a year in the making. But yes, a little bit random, out of the blue, coming here in the middle of April. I don't think it'll obviously have anything to do with government, because they are not members of the royal family. This will be a totally independent private tour. However, we saw them go to Jordan only a few weeks ago, and that was on a humanitarian visit. And they did visit refugee camps where that was holding Syrian refugees there. So and that was in collaboration with the World Health Organization. So, you know, it may be that other bodies are involved in this. Certainly the idea that they say that it's a business trip is an interesting one. So I would wonder if that business is funding this tour. All will be revealed, no doubt.
All will be revealed. A couple of texts here backing what you're saying. look, they're not on tour, it's a private capacity. So Rita is asking, why are we asking such a question about Harry and Meghan? Do you ask such questions about other celebrities who come here in a private capacity for the work they do? Or are you encouraging the hate that's unfounded towards Meghan especially? Rita, thank you for letting me know what you think. Juliet, I'm interested in what you think about that capacity for people. Clearly, a few people on text are making this distinction. Do you think that they will be considered just private citizens on tour when they come here?
Look, there's always a little bit of that royal magic and stardust there when anyone meets a member of the royal family. Harry is still a prince. Harry is still the son of the king. They are still Duke and Duchess of Sussex. So, you know, there's a little bit of that that washes over it and the excitement of meeting them. But yes, they're private citizens. They are here to, you know, they will be here on that, you know, private business and philanthropic engagements. I have no doubt something will involve the Invictus Games, for instance. Here in Australia, we have an Invictus team. The Games are happening next year in Birmingham in the UK in July. Harry is off to the UK for the 1 year out promotion. I'm sure he would like to touch base with some of those Australian Invictus athletes whilst he's here. And that, of course, would involve dealing with the Australian Defence for that organisation. But, you know, with regards to the funding of this, your listener is completely right. We don't ask that question of celebrities that come here. Usually the film companies or the record companies fund those tours. And I imagine that whoever the business is will be funding this tour, perhaps also with some of Harry and Meghan's own money, if it's philanthropic. They have a lot of philanthropic ventures that are connected to different organisations all over the world.
And we've also, I have, set up a little bit of a straw man here to say, look, should we be spending money on them? As people are pointing out, they are still royals. They're not working royals. I cheekily say, will taxpayers' dollars go towards security and so forth? But that's the problem, isn't it, with this ambiguity? I would imagine that there would be some potential ask of a government to give them some security. They've talked about needing security, even with their, you know, their ambiguous status at the moment. What do you think about the sort of attitude that state or federal governments might take towards this?
Look, I think that they will undoubtedly be travelling with their own private security, as they do in America. They don't have government security there. And it will depend on whether there are public events that involve members of the public. And in the same way as any other celebrity in a public space may need some security there, that will, you know, that may happen. But I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of optics around where public money is spent. So any government, state or federal, will be taking that request very seriously and thinking hard about what the people of Australia want, as well as the security of both Harry and Meghan and anyone who, any members of the public who may turn out to see Harry and Meghan. I don't know whether there will be any public events. It doesn't suggest that there are public events. If they are private, behind closed doors, organised by philanthropic companies or by businesses or by private individuals, then surely the security would be down to them.
Mm. You're listening to Juliet Reedon, ABC's royal commentator. And I guess part of this, the backdrop to this, which is much more serious, is that they will undoubtedly be asked about Andrew, if indeed, as you say, the media has any overlap with this trip, any way of getting to them. My understanding is that neither Harry nor Meghan have spoken about the allegations about Andrew Mountbatten. Could that possibly be their way of getting into the topic? If they make a statement in Australia, that's some way of potentially getting themselves at some distance on the record from Andrew?
Look, I think we're jumping ahead of ourselves a bit here. Firstly, they would have to be asked something. I don't think they would put anything on the record as a statement unless someone asked them. a question, and that someone would, of course, be a member of the pesky media. And and if the media manages to get in front of them, I'm sure that someone in the media will want to ask that question. And, you know, if I was advising Harry and Meghan and they were asked that question, I would say, as the royal family has said, that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor is no longer a member of the working royal family. He is a private citizen, and only Andrew Mountbatten Windsor can answer for his actions. I would also suggest that they would say that their thoughts would be with the victims of Jeffrey Epstein in this matter. I suspect if anything like that happens, that would be roundabout what they would say. Mm. But I don't know.
And just further to that, we've seen some more ripples from that seismic event, which is those allegations against Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. One of his daughters has had to walk away from her UK charity.
Yes, this is Princess Eugenie. She's had to step down as patron of the UK charity Anti-Slavery International. Now, she's been patron of that charity for 7 years, and she's been very committed to it. Of course, this is in the wake of the scandal surrounding her father's connections with Jeffrey Epstein. The optics on that are very poor. Nobody is suggesting that Princess Eugenie has done anything wrong. Of course, Andrew himself is still saying that he did not do anything wrong and he hasn't been convicted. However, the optics are not great, and I'm sure she is thinking of the charity and how it would play out for them in stepping back. She's actually also got another charity that she set up in the same space called the Anti-Slavery Collective. She set that up in 2017, and that is still ongoing. So we will see whether anything happens to that charity as well. Obviously, the actual, you know, the idea that both of these charities are about modern slavery is a very poor fit with her father's the accusations against her father.
Yes, the troubles for that family are not over yet. Juliet, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure.
That's Juliet Reedon, author and ABC's royal commentator. Judith says, just a thought, if they don't want attention, why have they announced it if it's purely business? I believe Jared in Macedon is someone who says that Harry and Meghan may no longer be royals, but I still think they'll get police escorts and a green wave while they're in Melbourne. Deb says taxpayers shouldn't pay 1 cent for this. Susan says we don't need two entitled ex-royals here. They aren't royals. We don't need to spend any tax dollars on them. Of course, yes, they are not working royals. They are royals. They do. They have announced this, though. It'll be interesting to see what comes of it and what the Australian public's view of it is, what your view of it is. They're coming to Melbourne. I'd love to have your calls and texts about this today.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
If you haven't heard this, let's have a listen to Timothée Chalamet throwing shade at opera and ballet.
I don't want to be working in ballet or opera or, you know, things where it's like, hey, keep this thing alive, even though no one cares about this anymore. Yeah. All respect to the ballet and opera people out there. I just lost 14 cents in viewership.
Yes, how much skin has that superstar lost? Hi, Liz, you had a viewpoint on this?
Look, I think his comments are hilarious because it shows how out of touch he is actually with the arts.
Yep.
You know, like little Timmy C has been in a movie about ping pong. That's going to be forgotten in 5 years, maybe tops, whereas opera and ballet have been going for hundreds of years. They will continue to go for hundreds of years. And when people think about actors, who now remembers Rudolph Valentino, who was the greatest actor of all time in the 20s and 30s? Nobody remembers them. Nobody's going to remember Timmy, but they are going to remember opera and ballet because they'll still be living art forms.
Liz, I love those fighting words. Can I ask you to consider if there is at least something like a nugget of truth in the fact that they are not mainstream arts, and while he may not have been saying he doesn't like it, he is pointing out a harsh truth. Do you cop that?
No, but art doesn't have to be mainstream. Mm. Art takes so many different formats. And if we said, oh, look, we only will take the mainstream, think of what narrow art we would have. Nothing would grow and flourish. And in any event, he should be worrying about his job with AI coming for actors' roles.
Oh, Liz, that is an excellent burn. Thank you very much. Really great to hear from you. Do you agree with Liz? My next guest is potentially rolling up her sleeves. Linda Thompson is founder of Australian Contemporary Opera and joins us now. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for talking to me.
What did you make of those comments?
Oh, look, I think his regret was swift.
And
his PR people probably let him down by not drilling that you never say no one or everyone in the media because there's always someone that cares deeply about something. I do think he's got a point in that opera and ballet and cinema, as he was talking, are struggling to connect widely. And I think the real challenge is funding, not interest or talent or ideas. It's about, recognising the normal social value of more funding so that everyone who cares or who might care, given the chance, gets to sit in a seat.
Mm. I found great pleasure in reading a New York Times op-ed about this, if people want to go and see, say that he's got a point. And one of the points that this op-ed was making was that one of the main reasons the mainstream media is talking about ballet and opera this week is because a celebrity talked about it first. It's an irony, but actually this is one of the best promotional opportunities that anyone could have given ballet and opera, isn't it?
Well, especially because we opened a contemporary opera at the Malt House and our review had more views than we've ever had within an hour. It was incredible. So the good publicity, bad publicity theory is playing out. I do think that it's like you can't say no one cares about an art form. It's like saying no one cares about books because they're all too complex and varied to dismiss in that way. He's only 30 years old, so we are finding that we are reaching 30-year-olds in opera through contemporary opera, not necessarily the mainstay of the major companies, but the more independent fringe type experiences, connecting with 30-year-olds in a way that we haven't seen before. So, I mean, we have a 30-year-old director, 30-year-old costume designer, composer and conductor in their 30s. So I think this is just a challenge for Timothée to get to a contemporary opera. But I do think he went to a performing arts high school in New York. His sister went to ballet school. He went to the Fame School with a friend of mine's daughter.
Oh.
So it won't be that he hasn't seen opera. It may be that he hasn't seen the type of opera that he will appreciate.
I must admit, I think that people have conflated what he said. I think there were still quotation marks about no one likes this anymore. I think that's what he was saying other people say. And he was talking about the virtues of working in one of those art forms versus cinema. What you're saying is that you would agree with him on that point, that essentially it's almost ballet and opera essentially needing to work too hard to showcase their value, that they need more heroes behind the scenes, they need more philanthropists, they need more funding.
All of that. And also we don't have, I can't think of an opera singer performing today that has the star pulling power of a Timothée Chalamet. So we do struggle to be heard. But I do think that we're offering, in terms of cinema, opera and ballet are offering the same sorts of experiences where audiences are choosing to switch off their phones, sit together for a shared experience. And I think even sitting through challenging stories and challenging judgments is a powerful reminder of what we share as human beings, that not everybody has to like the same things, enjoy the same things, but just sitting there and experiencing the stories is the main thing. And you can't distinguish between, well, I think that maybe cinemas are more comfortable and we need recliners for opera maybe. But I think that the increasingly people are looking for human-driven experiences.
Well, as our caller Liz said before, AI is on the way potentially for Timothée, so opera and ballet presumably won't be a victim to that. While I've got you on the line there, Linda, I'm going to go to Ido in Brunswick. I hope I'm saying your name right. Ido, you are here to defend opera, is that right?
Yes, look, Ido, that's my name. Look, Mum took me to the ballet when I was young, you know, at 50, some young age, 70, 80, and she just grabbed me by the back of the coat, you know, and said, sit there and watch this sort of thing. And I hated it. But then when I was 21 or something, you'd go to the opera for, you know, a student rush sort of thing, on a Monday, as I should remember, and I've been hooked ever since.
Oh, and, really? How often would you go, Ido?
Well, I go on the tram from Brunswick here and the Palais to Kilda or the Regent at these days. And, of course, in the old days, it was the Arts Centre. And you'd get to know the people beside you, you know, share lollies, bits and pieces. But the drama, the thing just gets to you after a while. As I say, I've been going forever. I've been to the Verdi Festival in Italy about four times. And but then again, you can, like I'm saying, it's not necessarily grand all the time.
Mm.
We've got so many companies here. We've got the Melbourne Opera, the Victorian Opera, you know, even smaller operas than that. We've got the Sydney Opera Company comes to visit us every now and then. It's humming, it's going, and I just think you've got to walk in the door like I did. Not with my mother that time with the ballet, but with the opera, and it works for her, doesn't it? And the stories are normal, even if it's a 100-year-old story, 200-year-old story, it's still dramatic. I mean, Madame Butterfly, Love Bohème.
They still resonate.
I cry through Love Bohème, I try not to, but every time it just works.
Ido, thank you so much for calling. I love hearing that firsthand, that it started so long ago with your mum dragging you in. Linda, I think you should be employing Ido as part of your marketing.
Well, we love it that we get feedback from people who are 16 years old saying my first opera and 80 years old saying my first opera. We love it. I mean, it's just it's an inspiration to us that people are coming to opera, particularly contemporary opera, at any stage of their lives. And then caring. I do think that the finding of its value is actually experiencing it live to understand the value and particularly in contemporary opera where English is the predominant language, we feel that we connect with Australian audiences very deeply.
Yeah. Let's give little Timmy C, as Liz would say, let's give him his moment of repentance here. He has opened up for you a window for at least ballet and opera people to get out in public and say, listen, this is what we have on offer. Tell me, what have you got on offer, Linda?
We have an Irish double bill, Australian premiere, called Mary Motorhead and Trade, and they're playing at the Malthouse until Friday the 13th of March.
It sounds interesting. What's that about?
Yes. Well, where do we start? Okay, so it's ordinary people, bad choices. Mary's locked in a prison cell and explains that her theory is that everybody has a big history, where they come from and things that happen to them, and then their secret history is the things that they reveal that as a reason for why they do what they do. Trade is a two-hander, so an older man and a younger man meeting in a dingy hotel room for sexual transaction, and again, it's the spilling of the guts. It's just it's visceral, it's powerful, beautiful Irish storytelling with an all-Australian cast and a Grammy-nominated conductor.
So if anyone agreed with Timothée and said that opera is stuck in the past, listen to those plots and you'll know that's not true. Linda Thompson, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Mary.
That is Linda Thompson, who is founder of the Australian Contemporary Opera Company, and obviously opera is up and kicking as far as she's concerned, and for a lot of you as well. We've been talking about this. Tony says, he's not convinced. I'm sure opera is fantastic, but I've never met anyone that's been, just for rich ponces. You know, it went and has been his whole life, Tony. You've listened to him. We've also been talking in our other barbecue stopping question about Harry and Meghan. Am I is this bad? Am I just clickbait? Is it a problem that we've been raising this today? Some of the people listening are saying, yes, why are you even looking at this? Others are saying, we don't want them here. Why are they coming? Kay from Wodonga, what do you think?
Well, I just think that there seems to be a marvellous excuse when they say they're going to do something to immediately hate the idea, to immediately say, we don't want them here. I think we as Australians should practice being kind. I mean, every which way they turn, they are vilified. It doesn't matter what they do. I think they've had years and years and years of vilification. And if they are private citizens, let's just treat them like that and be kind instead of preempting hatred. I have a problem with that.
Yeah, it's good to hear your point of view, Kay. As a journalist, I'm genuinely curious as to whether people think that the media should be asking them about Andrew. What do you think?
I think it's inevitable because that's what the media do.
Mm.
But again, I think if you are allowing them to come and be private citizens, just let them do what they do.
Thank you so much for calling, Kay. I love getting your calls. We will keep talking about both of those things as we continue. And also later, the great things. Kay was talking about people being kind, some really kind people doing great things to help people in the justice system. But next, are we fooling ourselves about the future of Australian women's sport?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, women's sport is in our headlines a lot of the time, and sometimes for very poignant reasons. We will talk about the Iranian women's soccer team in this conversation. But also we saw over the past week or so the Tillies. We saw last night they were kept to a draw with South Korea in the Asian Cup, and they've been getting headlines. And the Tillies are the shining light for us, aren't they, that say to us that women's sport is finally okay. It might not be exactly where we want it to be right now, but it's on an unstoppable rise in coverage and opportunity and economic investment. But my next guest is arguing that despite Australia's success in women's sport, it's still potentially, well, I'll put this to her, are we still on shaky ground because we don't have a national strategy guiding it? And what would a national strategy do? What would it do for the girls and women in your lives who are at community sport? What would it do for their facilities, for their sponsorship, for their coverage? I'd love to hear from you about what you think is happening with women's sport. Are you seeing this success where you are, where you live? Sarah Stiles is a leading figure in Australian Sports Administration. She served as the Director of Office for Women in Sport and Recreation and is a board member of the Victorian Institute of Sport. And it's wonderful to be speaking with you here, Sarah.
And it's wonderful to be having this conversation with you, of all people, with everything that you've done over your career, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. I want to get to the national strategy because it sounds dry, but it really, really isn't. It's about what things can actually happen on the ground. But let's talk briefly about the Iranian women who are here, who played last night in the Philippines. Everyone's watching a very tense diplomatic situation now. What's your take on it?
I mean, even just a short while ago, I saw Tracy Holmes has posted, you know, the team buses at their hotel. You know, there is difficulty in the team accessing services, or they're being kept from being able to speak to people. And so, I mean, for people who aren't aware, over the last week, I mean, they're going to be aware what's happening in Iran, but the team's opening match, the team did not sing the national anthem. And that apparently was enough for them to be labelled as traitors on state television back home. So the conversation at the moment is, are these women genuinely at risk of, like, going home and their safety being at risk? So, you know, for me right now, with the conversation that is happening, I just hope people are able to focus on what is best for those players. I think there's a lot of people using this situation to perhaps talk about the wider geopolitical landscape, but we can't forget there's a group of very young women who are experiencing a level of pressure right now that almost all of us will never know in our lives. And I just want them to be safe.
Exactly. A real reminder of just how powerful sport can be in terms of empowering women and sports people and cultures who might need that empowerment. Yet on the other hand, it doesn't guarantee anything, does it?
It doesn't. And I mean, even what you said at the outset around, you know, the Matildas, the incredible few years that they've had, even overnight, the Australian women's cricket team winning their test match against India in Perth, Elisa Healy's final ever game before she was retiring from international cricket. Just last week, the WNBL, the championship, Townsville took that one out, record crowds under the new ownership there. But perception doesn't always meet reality. And sometimes I think we like to tell ourselves things have changed significantly and we're in, you know, we're in this gender equal world, especially after International Women's Day yesterday. Yeah. This year's theme all around balance the scales, particularly through a justice lens. Reality is, yeah, perception doesn't always meet reality. And that reality still has an enormous gulf in the visibility of opportunities and how we cover women's sport, an enormous gulf in the investment gap, what these women are getting paid, if they're getting paid at all. And for me, that represents opportunity.
Yeah. Just to wrap up, the latest reporting on the Iranian women's soccer team is that a source in the Australian Iranian community said that activists were going to the AFP to seek urgent protection for the women. That's reporting in the Nine newspapers. So obviously this is going to be something to watch. But we are talking about the national women's strategy. This is something that you've been promoting. I'm just going to tell you about a text that I've just got in from Earl in Caulfield South. Do we have a national men's strategy?
Yeah, it's a great question. And inevitably around International Women's Day, the question normally is, well, when's International Men's Day? It's later in the year, I think November 19th. Yeah. So there is a national sports strategy. There is also, Australia has a national gender equality strategy. And in that strategy, it talks to the importance of sport and the visibility of women in sport. It then points to the national sports strategy, which then doesn't actually tackle this stuff. So there is good intentions, but the opportunity here is how can we actually say what we're going to do to drive change? So, you know, we've got Brisbane 2032 Olympics in 6 years' time. There has been research on the legacy plans for that tournament or that event that have actually found it risks entrenching inequality.
And just to interrupt you, I'm terribly sorry, no, Sarah, right. But I read that and I tried to read the article and I'll be honest, it's an academic article and it left me a little bit cold. It was a little esoteric. Can you spell it out for people? These legacy plans, to spell that out, that's the sort of planning that you do that justifies the enormous cost of hosting an Olympics by tying it towards what we can expect as payoff in the future.
Spot on.
So what about the Olympic strategy is lacking there when it comes to women?
Yep, you're spot on there that every major event, whether it's sport or not sport, would talk about what is the legacy it's leaving behind? How is this even bigger than just simply people turning up to watch? So the risk is with any of this, we talk about, oh yeah, we want to drive change for gender equality, full stop. It's in the detail, though, that change happens. So if we don't have the detail, then we are looking forward, hoping for the best, and wherever we end up, we end up. But if you actually articulate what do we want it to look like at that point in time, what do we want it to feel like? And that can be for anything. It can be, for example, there is a huge focus in those legacy documents around opportunities for First Nations athletes. So it's if we articulate what exactly it is we want to be, then we can say, well, how are we going? Are we making progress? Or we don't know.
So what you're saying is there are those plans, but they're just too vague.
They're too vague. And we want to have big ambitions. My view is Australia should be the most thriving women's sports country in the world. We've got the infrastructure there to do it. I mean, we've got those leagues. We've got those incredible athletes. I mean, we're just off the back of the most successful Winter Olympics we've ever had. Mm. I was watching that opening ceremony. I think they described us as the most successful warm weather country in the Olympic Games. Don't know how accurate that one is, but anyway, we've got that there. It's just how do we articulate what our big ambitions is and how do we bring that to life?
So what do you think? Brisbane 2032, that's right, isn't it?
it's weird to say it isn't. 2032, when did that happen?
Yeah, that's right. That's in Jetson's era. Oh, no, it's just around the corner. When we have those games, what would success for women's sport look like, both in the elite area and grassroots?
Well, for me, I think it's actually the connection point between the two. Mm-hmm. There is incredible things that happen and there's incredible things that a lot of people are pushing, but we're not making inroads around closing the visibility gap and the investment gap. And so that means we're always going to have this incredible behemoth of men's sport that is undermining everything else. So I want us to be focusing on what can we be doing there? How are we engaging people with women's sport? How are we engaging corporate Australia right down to your local community when you're sponsoring your local football netball players? How do we get people realising we need to be backing our women? Because the impact of that goes far beyond sport.
Sarah, you were just talking then about sponsors and economic sort of backing. So who's ultimately responsible for fixing this? We love to have some blame. I'm sure there's enough blame to spread around. If you had to look at it from the point of view of government, sports themselves, sponsors.
Great question. Because the thing for me is I never try and frame this stuff as blame. I frame this as opportunity. And just if we think about whether you are your local club and the number of stories I've heard of clubs, they're like, oh, God, like a cricket club, we got a women's team for the first time. This is now such a better, more thriving place to be. So this is opportunity. My view is that there is no one single organisation that's actually responsible for this. That's part of the challenge. It falls between the cracks. So this needs to be a collaboration at a national level and then working down with states and territories to go, what can we be doing here collectively? So I see this needing national leadership.
Full disclosure, yes, when I hear strategy, I think that's great. There's obviously a really, there's lots of really great intentions behind something. But, you know, it's so often used as a box ticking exercise, or at least it feels like that when there are so many strategies that have already happened. No doubt, even in the women's sports sector, even if it has been piecemeal, and it just doesn't get tied to action. So what would be the key to making a national strategy actually work for people?
So a big one for me is how do we break past this idea that we always have to pretend everything is amazing? So UN Women, for people who are familiar with UN Women, over the summer put out a global guide for how do countries want to be driving change in this space? Because sport is important. Sport is so much more than sport. And one of the six things they said was important was transparency. And I think that's the key there. How can we say, look, this is where we're trying to go, and we're not going to pretend if we're not making inroads that we're going to say we are. Let's just say where we are. This is something when I used to be at Cricket Australia, we used to do every year. We would say, you know what, we think we've done a great job here, and we are struggling here. This is harder than we thought it would be. Who can actually help us there? We need a little bit more of that in life. How do we just be honest on how things are going rather than pretending, yep, we've got this. This is awesome. We don't need to change anything.
Yeah. This has come in from Andrew on text. The elephant in the room is, and I'd love to have you address this, Andrew reckons that more than 70% of sport is viewed by men, and if women want more visibility and growth, then women themselves have to become interested and start playing, attending and watching sport. Does that stack up?
Not necessarily, unfortunately. And I mean, we should keep in mind the incredible success of men's AFL is because that fan base is disproportionately gender balanced compared to football codes around the world. It is successful because women are massive fans of men's AFL. And the flip side of that is some of the biggest fans of women's sport are men. So, you know, there's some work that actually showed around the world. It's something like 72%. Feel free to let me know if I've got the stat wrong. 72% of women worldwide describe themselves as avid fans of at least one sport. So it's kind of this stereotype of, oh, no, women, you don't like that. You know, and rather than a reflection of why don't women feel safe and comfortable coming into these environments that actually aren't haven't been built for them and their preferences.
Yeah, I must admit, Andrew, you know, I'd love to have you on the line as well to discuss it, but I can't think of a woman in my life who actually says, I want nothing to do with sport. Maybe the women I hang around with, of course. You're listening to Sarah Stiles, who's a board member of the Victorian Institute of Sport, had many, many roles in sports administration and knows about this stuff and is arguing for a national strategy when it comes to women's sport. So if this strategy gets taken up, has some accountability attached to it, Sarah, and we all get fair dinkum about it, what would people notice as spectators, whether they go to games, watch it on TV, you know, people who aren't, you know, involved with their community groups or their sports, how might a national strategy change what we see and hear?
I'm going to describe this in a really probably strange way. This morning, one of the chat groups that I am in, because you're right, I've had the great fortune of doing this style of work for a long time, there was a photo shared from the overnight Matildas game up in Sydney. So the one against South Korea, they landed in a draw, and it was of her son and her son's friends who are just there watching sport. They're not there watching women's sport. Mm-hmm. They're not there because they think it's warm and fuzzy, we're doing this for, you know, whatever. They're doing that because they're there to watch great sport for a team and some athletes that they love watching. Like Mary Fowler, you know, these people are superstars.
Yeah.
That's what it would feel like. We have moved past this idea of, oh, women's sport, the little pat on the head, little sister.
It's a two-edged sword, isn't it? Because you're absolutely right. The women's cricket team and soccer team basically are at least, if not more popular than their male counterparts in many ways. And as I sort of had a provocative statement, does that mean that we're fooling ourselves? And to step back from that a little, is there a possibility that that sort of momentum masks what is missing?
I think it goes back to that idea of that sometimes the perception of change doesn't actually meet the reality. And that's where we've just got to be honest with ourselves. And for people who are perhaps less passionate about sport, because people are allowed to have different passions, as we just learned from the person who I didn't realize his name wasn't Timothy up until today. if we think about where we want to go as a country and a gender equal Australia, reality is that will not be possible without sport playing a fundamental role of that. Sport has such a huge cultural impact on this country, on our communities, on the towns I grew up in, that we need to drive change there if we just simply want to be the country we want to be. And that's what it comes back to.
Sarah Stiles, good luck with all of that.
Thanks. Oh, there you go. We've solved it. Yeah, we've solved
right. No, you bring such a depth of understanding about this, and I just think you've got, hopefully, with those Olympics, you've got some tailwinds behind you.
Thank
into the Olympics. Thank you. Sarah Stiles, who's ex-director of the Office for Sport and Women and Recreation, board member of Victorian Institute of Sport, ex-Cricket Australia. You heard it all there. I'd love to hear what you think about that as well. It is coming up to 11 minutes to 12. We were talking about Timotei, and he's throwing shade at ballet and opera. Alison in Ringwood East, you've called in. What do you think?
Oh, look, it's really tricky, right? Because, you know, he works in the industry. And
do you?
I think it's a bit of a... So I'm on the organising committee for Choral Fest, which is a choir conference and festival that's happening in Geelong in about 4 weeks, actually.
All right.
And we're bringing 1,000 singers to Geelong for 4 days of singing and learning. We're really excited about it.
I mean, we're talking about opera because Timothée Chalamet has provoked us into doing that. do you see this as a little bit of an ironic opportunity to get the word out there, Alison?
A little bit, yeah.
How many people do you expect to come?
We've got 1,000 singers from across Australia coming, and some from New Zealand. We've got educators from Europe, along with Australia's top singing educators coming. And singing is one of, you know, the oldest human activities.
Yeah.
It builds community, improves mental health.
Alison, where should people go if they want information?
They can go to our website, so www.anca.org.au, and find all the info there.
Alison, thank you for calling, and I'm really happy to have put a provocative question out there for people as, you know, what they think about opera and ballet, and to have this answer come back at me. Yeah, we really do. We have been talking about quite a few things in this hour. Let's talk next, though, about the wonderful people doing great things to help others in the justice system. It can be so hard to navigate, whether you're a victim of a crime or accused of a crime or even a perpetrator, but even more so if you live with a disability. And we have things called the Independent Third Person Program Awards. They honour Victorian police members who've conducted outstanding work to support people with disability during their contact with the justice system. It's via a program that is a network of volunteers who sit in on police interviews to help people with disability navigate the justice system. And Dan Stubbs joins us now. He is Victoria's public advocate to tell us all about it. Hi, Dan.
Morning, Mary. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Tell me, give me examples of why this issue is important. What good practice looks like in this area?
Yeah, so we have a significant number of people with intellectual disabilities who are interviewed by police right across the state every day, usually in relation to them being accused of a crime, but sometimes if they're a witness to a crime or a victim of a crime. And often people with intellectual disabilities, in fact, anybody being interviewed by police, it's a very stressful situation. And if you are someone with a cognitive impairment, you're going to have, you know, a lot more stress and really have trouble to understand what you've been caught up in and what's going on around you. And of course, sometimes these people have committed a crime and the police need to interview them for good reason. But to have someone sitting with you in that room to make sure that things go at the right pace for you and so that you can understand what's being said to you in that interview, and sometimes even stop the interview or just take a moment to make sure that the person with disability is not maybe getting upset or escalating in some way, is incredibly helpful to everyone in the room, obviously particularly mm-hmm. the person with disability, but it's a profoundly important process that the public advocate support people with intellectual disabilities with.
So are these volunteers getting the awards?
So these awards are actually the volunteers nominate some different police stations and some different police for the work they've done. So it's actually the volunteer independent third persons who nominate some different police stations for their excellent practice. So
it sounds like the volunteers should get awards, though, to be completely honest with you, Dan.
We do recognise them. And this time, however, we wanted to really highlight the police stations that do well in this space. Because, you know, some do better than others. Not all police stations are fully taking up the opportunity to draw on the independent third persons and the support they can provide.
Do you have enough volunteers?
Probably never enough. We have about 100 ITP volunteers across the state, and they work pretty hard, some of them incredibly hard because they're often called out at night or in the middle of the night, and you know, and sometimes in challenging circumstances where someone's really maybe heightened and upset, and maybe they have committed a crime. So we provide a lot of training for these volunteers, and they really are superstars. They're incredible when you meet them, and they're so humble about the fact that they're doing this work because they really believe in it. So it's so impressive to meet these people who do this work as independent third persons. Mm.
You're listening to Dan Stubbs, Victoria's public advocate. I understand you're keen to get that role strengthened and introduced into legislation. And in the light of that, I'm going to read a text to you from Nick, who asks, why does this program need to exist? Shouldn't the police treat everyone the same? What would you say to Nick?
I totally understand that. And it's probably important to remember that the police are in the interview and they have a particular objective. And for all of us standing on the outside thinking, well, the police's role is to make sure things go fairly, but really the police are pretty focused on getting charges laid. And the fact is we do see a way over representation of people with intellectual disabilities and all cognitive impairments in the justice system. And this, having someone else in the room to just make sure that they're focused on the rights and needs of that person with disability does make a significant difference and actually supports the police to do their role and focus on what they're doing. So we have tried to, and we do make sure that police receive really good training around this, but it's what we've found really works is having that other person in the room. Mm. And I think that's the practical way forward that we need to grow.
Just briefly, Dan, this on text, and it does echo a couple of other texts. Never heard of them when I required them, always too late. Can you give some tips on how people can access them if they need them?
Yeah. We're first of all, we want people to say, I want an independent third person with me, and that can be someone's family member or their advocate or even their lawyer, or the person themselves needs to say that. But we are seeing growth year on year. We're seeing police get better at this. Last year, we had almost 5,500 interviews done with independent third persons, and that's been growing at around 10%. So we are seeing police get better at this, but it is uneven. So in some police stations, we have big numbers, particularly in regional areas. Actually, the regional coppers are right onto this, but in some of the metro areas where we should be seeing many more IGP volunteers, not so many. So we're talking to police about how we grow that, because I think it's often a culture in the police station about that.
Oh, that's a whole other talk as well. Dan Stubbs, thank you for giving us your time, and good luck with all of that.
Thanks so much, Mary.
That's Dan Stubbs, Victoria's public advocate. Thank you for having me on my very first Conversation Hour. It's been wonderful to be with you. If you want to listen to any of this again, or send it to your friends, look for the podcast on the ABC Listen app. I will be back again in this chair tomorrow. Really looking forward to it. Thank you for all your texts and calls today. Join you then.